From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a bedtime story told by a president. We talk with Jimmy Carter and his daughter Amy about the new book they've collaborated on. It's a story he used to tell his children when they were young. Amy did the illustrations. We'll talk about the book and about family life in the White House. Also today, old-time religion in the Blue Ridge Mountains. We talk with novelist and poet Robert Morgan. His new novel is based on a religious quarrel in his family that dates back to the previous century, dividing the churchgoers from the revivalists. And more gift ideas from linguist Jeff Nunberg, books about language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole is accusing President Clinton of making the quest for a budget agreement more difficult. UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports Dole is urging the president to make a new budget offer.
Dole took to the Senate floor sounding grim about prospects for a budget deal.
Unless we can accomplish something serious by Friday, it's probably not going to happen this year. I'm not in a position to announce the schedule for the balance of the year, but the balance of the year is about here. New Year's Eve is not far off, and I assume we'll be here.
But neither side says it's hopeless, and last week there was some movement toward the center by both sides. Meantime, about 250,000 federal workers are laid off for the second time in a month. The money for their salaries is tied up by policy differences between the Republican Congress and the Democratic president. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Those federal workers reported to their jobs this morning before being sent home. While they were going home, the president was vetoing two spending bills, and he's likely to veto a third later today because of provisions the White House says would threaten the environment and undermine various administration programs. American transport planes landed in Bosnia today with cargo and troops as work to set up a U.S. base of operations in Tuzla gets into full swing. Flights had to be delayed for several days because of heavy fog. Trains full of equipment and U.S. soldiers rumble toward the border between Bosnia and Croatia. Those troops will be building a bridge that will be used for U.S. forces traveling overland to Bosnia. Israel and Syria resume their negotiations in Washington next week. The two sides will again take up a land for peace strategy for concluding a peace treaty. Working out a peace agreement between Israel and Syria is now the top priority of Secretary of State Warren Christopher. Barry Schwide reports.
He's 70 and has an ulcer, but his bags are packed. Christopher is going back to the Middle East in January. Whatever the outcome of the Syrian-Israeli negotiations, that will reopen in Washington Christmas week. And he's ready to shuttle back and forth between Damascus and Jerusalem if that's what it takes to get an agreement. Syrian President Hafez Assad and Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres have told Christopher they want to reach an accord, and since Peres has signaled his willingness to satisfy Assad's principal demand, return to the Golan Heights, the basis for a deal exists. Christopher worked overtime to get a Bosnia agreement. He's just as determined now to get an Israeli-Syrian agreement on the books in what is likely to be his last year as Secretary of State. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Stock prices are tumbling sharply today, spurred by a combination of the federal budget stalemate, uncertainty over the direction of interest rates, and a big sell-off of high-tech issues. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average currently is down just over 100 points at 5,076 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite is down 25 points. This is NPR News. Transportation Secretary Federico Peña has announced a delay in implementation of new trucking regulations that have sparked fears about road safety and environmental protection in the states bordering Mexico. Peña says the regulations, which are part of the North American Free Trade Agreement, will not take effect until the U.S. and Mexico decide how to improve safety and efficiency standards. The Federal Reserve's Policy Setting Open Market Committee meets tomorrow to consider whether to cut interest rates for the second time this year. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
After lowering short-term interest rates in July for the first time in nearly 3 years, the Fed has held monetary policy steady. Opinion among analysts is mixed as to what action the central bank will take tomorrow. Slowing economic growth, subdued inflation, and the risk that any balanced budget deal will act as a drag on the economy are factors that argue in favor of a rate reduction. arguing against the move to lower interest rates as an economy that is running near full capacity, resilient financial markets that some Fed officials fear may be overheated, and the central bank's desire to make further progress in the fight against inflation. The Fed has been giving conflicting signals about whether it will move to lower interest rates. Some Fed officials have argued that rates are too high and should be cut to ensure continued economic expansion through the new year. Others say they see no reason to rush into a rate reduction now at a time when unemployment is low and the economy is still growing. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin's government is hinting it might moderate free market reforms in the wake of major victories by communist and right-wing nationalists in parliamentary elections. A strong hardline showing was considered a rebuke of Yeltsin's painful economic reforms. Thousands of homes in Northern California are still without electricity nearly a week after a powerful windstorm hit the region. Utility groups hope to have power restored to most of those customers by the end of the day. That 200-foot-wide sinkhole that swallowed up a home in San Francisco has been filled in with rubble from the 1989 earthquake. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Since leaving the White House, Jimmy Carter has traveled around the world mediating international conflicts. He's also become a successful writer of nonfiction, memoirs, and poetry. His new book is a children's story, illustrated by his 25-year-old daughter, Amy, who is now studying art history in graduate school. Amy was 9 when her father was elected president. She'd spent most of her earlier life in the Georgia governor's mansion. We invited Jimmy and Amy Carter to talk with us about their new collaboration and what family life was like back when they were the first family. Their new book, The Little Baby Snoogle-Fleeger, is based on stories Jimmy Carter used to tell his children. It's about a lonely boy who was befriended by an intimidating underwater creature known as a snoogle-fleeger.
Well, this was a hero of a lot of stories that I told my children beginning maybe 40, 45 years ago. And this is a monster, but a young one, but still very large and extremely ugly. And he comes out of the ocean on occasion to become involved in adventures with little children who were about the same age as my children when I told them the stories. And he interrelates in a very exciting and dramatic way to help resolve some of their problems or to deal with crises that affect their lives. And so the little baby snoogle-fleeger is always fearsome to all the other kids, and usually in the stories, the hero of that particular story, the little child, is the only one who can relate to the little baby snoogle-fleeger. Because he is so ugly and formidable looking, he's a very lonely little creature. And he's always searching for friends, but rarely finds any. Spends his time underneath the ocean, underneath the waters, but he can come up to the top on occasion. And amazingly, he's able to speak different languages. In this particular case, he speaks English.
And he can actually be quite a friendly little monster, or a big monster. Amy, what did you like about the snoogle-fleeger stories when you were a kid?
Oh, well, they changed really rapidly in the telling, and there was always very exciting passages about wonderful treasures and cities under the ocean. And I guess it appealed to me because of the young child who is the protagonist. Mm-hmm. Having something magical happen to him that then sort of changed his life and allowed other people to see something in the monster that was beyond the way he looked on the surface. So the small child would bring other people into seeing the beauty of the sea monster.
Jimmy Carter, do you think you invented an undersea creature in part because you were stationed on a submarine in your military days?
Well, I think so. I probably began telling these stories when I was still on a surface ship, but I always had submarines in the back of my mind, and one of the submarines I was on was a killer submarine designed exclusively to hunt and destroy Soviet submarines if we should have had gone to war before they could hear us. It was extremely quiet and very small, and specially designed. So we would stay submerged for sometimes days at a time and listen to the sound of shrimp and whales and dolphins on our very elaborate sonar equipment. And I think there's no doubt that having an undersea creature become a startling hero came from my experiences underneath the water for sometimes days or even months at a time.
Amy Carter, your father describes the little baby Snugglefleecher as an ugly creature. How did you decide to draw it? What the colors you used, the shape you gave it, where did you get your visual impression from? How did you come up with it?
I actually looked at a lot of fish and old National Geographics.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to have his skin be sort of mottled. And I guess the only... Perhaps I didn't really try to make him as ugly as I could have, but I added his big teeth sort of in that way and just sort of green moldy colors. So
I should say for our listeners who are hearing unusual sounds in the background that is not the Snugglefleecher. That's actually the sounds of construction near the NPR studio in New York. So I hope that's not too distracting.
When we got the first drawings from Amy of the little baby Snugglefleecher, I was startled because for 40 years I had had a very clear picture of what the baby Snugglefleecher looked like, and so did my wife. But Amy's image of the Snugglefleecher was totally different from my own. It took us 2 or 3 days with Amy's with the photograph of Amy's first drawing on the mantelpiece. We would go by and look at it for a few minutes at a time, and it finally dawned on us that Amy's image of the baby Snugglefleecher was much superior to what we had always dreamed it looked like. So we were surprised with the appearance of the baby Snugglefleecher as little Jeremy was in the book.
Well, what was your impression of what the creature should look like? Would you have something more like Godzilla in mind?
No, not really. What I had was kind of a cross between a T-Rex and an Allosaurus or a Brontosaurus, more like a standard kind of dinosaur. This was in the days before dinosaurs, were cool. It was when dinosaurs were not known by many people, and so I always envisioned it looking more like a dinosaur. But I have to say that Amy Snugglefleecher does not look like a dinosaur.
So what was it like for the two of you to collaborate on something? sometimes it's very hard for family members to work together, or particularly to learn to drive from each other. That's something I don't recommend. But what was it like to work on a book together? I mean, Jimmy Carter, you're the father, and therefore are used to being in control or wanting to have control, but that's not the attitude to have when you're collaborating with somebody.
I had been through a horrible experience writing a book together with my wife a few years ago called Everything to Gain. It almost destroyed a marriage of 48 years because it was about a traumatic experience in our life, having been defeated for re-election as president, having lost all our money, having gone back home to an empty house with all our kids gone. And the book was advice on how other people might deal with these unexpected and difficult events. Rosa and I could agree on 97% of the text, but the 3% became paramount. And we had a horrible experience, literally. I'm not exaggerating. We could only communicate by writing ugly messages back and forth on our word processors. And it was only a very enlightened editor who saved our book and saved our marriage by finally taking those 3% of paragraphs and dividing them half and half, half of Jimmy's, half of Rosalind's. And you can put a J on your paragraphs. Rosen doesn't have to agree, and she can put an R on her paragraphs, and you don't have to agree. So we saved our book. So I went into this event with Amy with that as a historical background. This time, though, Amy was off at graduate school. I was in Plains, and I felt that it was my story and my image of a Snugglefleecher, and Amy just had to fill in the gaps. But it turned out that Amy has an artist's temperament when she decides on how something should look, how it should be presented. There's very little opportunity to change her mind. And I think not only did I discover this, but the art editor Times Books found this out. So there wasn't ever any chance for argument much. The only thing that we suggested was that the little Jeremy, who deals with the Snugglefleecher, might appear somewhat younger than Amy's first version. And I would say, I think Amy's sitting here looking at me, not knowing what I'm going to say, but I would think that her changes in the young kid's face were minuscule, but made him look younger. That's the only thing we ever had, but we got along quite well.
Amy, did you need family therapy by the time the book was done?
No, actually not. It went really smoothly. And I think part of that was just the timing in my life, and I suppose in Dad's life was really conducive to working together.
Why was the timing right in your life, Amy?
Just more, you know, I'm living in a place I love, and grad school's going really well, and I was just very calm about all sorts of family interactions and feeling good about that stuff. I think it would have been more difficult if I had tried to do this when I was younger.
Amy, I know that there was a period when you were at Brown University when you engaged in a student protest against CIA recruiting on campus. Mm-hmm. That ended up in a big court case. You spent a lot of time away from your actual schoolwork and ended up, I believe, being expelled. I'm wondering if that was a turning point in you deciding what you wanted to do, what you wanted to study and what you wanted to be. I mean, were you pursuing art then, or did that kind of little crisis get you onto a different and ultimately maybe more satisfying course?
Oh, I definitely think so. I was actually pursuing art to some degree at Brown,
mm-hmm.
but I guess it really made me consider what kind of environment I really felt comfortable in, instead of like the idea that I had been set up for, particularly by going to a prep school in Georgia that was sort of geared towards the Ivy League.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that came to a head. And I also returned to the South at that point and went to Memphis, which was really, I think, probably an important step for me, just in terms of the fact that moving so much, I needed some, or I felt like it was time to sort of deal with what area of the country was really my home and, like, explore Georgia to a fuller extent and be close to family and friends.
Mm-hmm. You went there. To Memphis College of Art.
Yep. I did.
Another thing was that Amy had been very active in demonstrations against apartheid in South Africa.
Right.
And she had already been arrested or detained 3 times before that. She was very active in college as a leader in that respect. But at the same time, I think very withdrawn and, if Amy will excuse my saying, the word shy person. She didn't want to be confronting TV cameras and news reporters, but she felt very deeply about these kinds of things.
Amy, it sounds like you're a mix of very shy and defiant.
I think that's exactly right.
That's one reason that we don't really argue with Amy when she tells us that she decided to do something. The defiant part.
Amy, you said that you know, you kind of learned early on how to make a strong case. Was this like part of growing up in the family, that you were supposed to make a very kind of logical case to defend your belief, whether it was political or what you wanted to do over the weekend?
Oh, absolutely. I think I actually share that. I might even consider that a primary trait of my family. I think that all of my brothers and my parents are very vocal, and there was always definitely a sense that that debate took place, even if people disagreed, everyone's opinion was heard.
And were the rules like if you could give a well-thought-out, logical explanation for what you wanted to do, that it would be more accepted?
Absolutely. Or even if it was disagreed with in the end, I definitely think that everyone in my family feels like their voice is heard.
Also, there are 2 or 3 members of our family who will take either side in order to create an argument. So we have some intense discussions or debates or arguments within our family, and always have since the kids were young. Mm-hmm. And Rosa and I have encouraged that. And I might add quickly that whether or not we had encouraged it, it would have occurred, because that's the kind of children we have.
My guests are Jimmy and Amy Carter. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Music.
Jimmy and Amy Carter are my guests, and they've collaborated on a new children's book called The Little Baby Snugglefleeter. Jimmy Carter wrote the story. Amy Carter did the illustrations. And this is a story that Jimmy Carter told to Amy Carter and to his older children as well. Child or children? Older?
Children. Three
boys. Oh, great. Okay. As well. Jimmy Carter, you were governor and president. Was there much time when you were in those positions to actually tell stories to Amy?
I think never enough. You know, this is something that you always find to be startling when you look back and maybe tabulate how many hours you actually spend with your sons or daughter whom you really love. And then you can go a year or so and all of a sudden realize, gee, I haven't spent but 2 or 3 days actually with my kids. Nowadays, we have a fixed habit of going off for at least a week with the whole family together. There are 18 of us. And we go skiing in Colorado or go down to Disney World or go to Belize or Panama or go on a Caribbean cruise. And we do that every year so that we can kind of get to know each other better and become acquainted. But this is a particularly exciting and unpredictable experience in my life, spending a few days with Amy on, you know, talking about this book, because I don't think I've ever had a real partnership before, even with my three sons. So I have approached it with some degree of trepidation. But I'm going to have to say this interview has helped me overcome some of my concerns.
How does a first family put aside time as family time? What family time did you actually have together in the White House?
Well, I'll let Amy answer that, too. But but I stayed, you know, in the Oval Office and worked pretty hard. And we had three grown sons and Rosalind, who were out a lot, who would meet with elderly people, meet with those who were interested in abortions, meet with those who were interested in education and health and welfare and so forth. And Amy was going to a public school in Washington. So around our dinner tables and so forth, supper tables, we had these intense discussions of what's going on in the world, what's going on out in the public school system or in the welfare lines. And it was a very wonderful education for me. Amy went to school the first morning as a 9-year-old child, and she was inundated with TV cameras and radio microphones being thrust in her face. And that evening on the television, they showed this little child struggling up the walkway with a large sack of books, abused really by dozens of eager reporters. All the reporters that were at the White House at that time, I think there were only 1,200 then, there are more now, got together after seeing this television display and pledged to one another they would leave Amy alone. So for the rest of the 4 years we were in the White House, she led a kind of a protected life. And she would bring her classmates to the White House to go swimming or to watch movies. And so I think she had a fairly normal life as a child within the bounds of, you know, living in the White House. Maybe Amy would disagree with me, but that was my impression.
Amy, how much family time did you actually have in the White House years?
I actually think from discussions with both my parents that they feel are more concerned about that than I remember or than I was at the time, because I really remember it as being very frequent. Like, there was never a time when I could not walk into anyone's office and speak to them. And I remember having dinners together. And
how often would you have dinner together?
I think we had, well, my memory might be shaky, but I think we had dinner together very regularly.
Almost every night. The only exception was when we had a state banquet and some king or president would come from a foreign country to have an official banquet. On a few occasions, Amy went to the official banquets,
mm-hmm.
and she was severely criticized
for reading.
For reading at the table.
I completely identify. I used to bring a book with me to a lot of family events and be roundly chastised for it. But, you know, I used to be really bored, to be honest, with a lot of adult events when I was a kid. It was like, well, they're talking about adult things, and, you know, I don't care. I'd rather watch TV. But Amy, when you were surrounded by adult events, it was, you know, like presidents from other countries and, you know, probably you know, famous performers who were doing White House performances and things like that. Were you interested in these very famous adults, or were they uninteresting to you also?
There are several that I remember meeting that I was really drawn to and happy to have known. Just kind of mixed group, but Sadat, I remember very vividly. He's one of the people that I met that I think I was most thrilled to meet because he was so kind and would come and say goodnight to me before he left. Which, and I think maybe it was the people who went out of the way to treat me, who went out of the way to say hello to the one who was young that I remember. Cher is actually another person I remember. I was completely overwhelmed by meeting Cher. And John Travolta, there are some really, you know, I was young and I really admired people.
That was when Cher was married to one of the Allman Brothers, right? And they both came.
And her fingernails, I still remember her fingernails because I thought they were so beautiful.
But they were really long. They're probably fake.
They were very long. But she was very sweet to me, too. She,
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, she spoke to me. I feel like she spoke to me about an hour alone. So I think it made me feel adult.
Yeah.
Probably.
I remember when King Hussein came to the White House the first or second time with his sons, and we had, I think Rosen had briefed Amy, you know, very carefully about, you know, your Royal Highness and so forth. And so as they approached each other, Amy said, "Hi, how you doing?" And we never did. And they relaxed very quickly and became friends.
Jimmy and Amy Carter, they collaborated on the new children's book, The Little Baby Snugglefleeger. They'll be back in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Speaking in Tongues. We talk with Robert Morgan. His new novel, The Truest Pleasure, is based on a religious rift in his family that dates back to the previous century in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg has some gift suggestions, and we continue our conversation with Jimmy and Amy Carter.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jimmy and Amy Carter. They've collaborated on a new children's book called The Little Baby Snooglefleecher. Jimmy Carter wrote the story. Amy Carter did the illustrations. She's now 25 years old, studying art history in graduate school. She was 9 when her father was elected president. We talked a little about what life was like when they were the first family. Did either of you ever really feel at home in the White House, or are you always conscious of the fact that it's a lot of people's homes and you're there for a finite amount of time?
No, I think we really felt surprisingly at home. I did. We had a good time. We enjoyed going to Camp David on the weekends. Amy would roller skate through the halls of the White House and swim in the pool. And Harry Truman did a nice thing when he was in the White House. He installed a bowling alley in the basement, so when the snow came and the rain was there, we could go down in the basement and bowl. And on Friday night, sometimes, Amy would bring almost her entire class from school, and they would watch movies all night. Mm-hmm. So there were some nice things there. And our family was very close. We had campaigned together, and that was my sons and their wives. And we had a team that was very cohesive. And as I said, Amy was kind of a second generation, but she was a darling of what was in effect 4 fathers. Our youngest son was 15 when Amy was born. Our oldest son was 20.
Amy, I know you were a congressional page for a while. Did you ever think about a political career?
No, never. I never considered it.
Why?
I'm just not...
Not cut out for it.
Not cut out for it.
And why not?
Because public speaking is just the very worst thing that I can imagine doing. I even have difficulties, you know, in class presentations in graduate school. I actually much prefer to write. I think just shy and not really about my opinions, but I don't speak very forcefully.
It must have been, I guess, very hard to grow up being seriously shy in an environment where all eyes are on you. I mean, you live in a show place. You're the first family. You're always in the spotlight.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it was a matter of being shy and having that happen, or if that is actually why I ended up being shy.
Oh, right. As a reaction against all the probing attention.
Yeah, I think that might be more the case.
Uh-huh. What advice would you both have for the public about what you think is our business and what you think is none of our business when it comes to the lives of the people in the White House?
You know, I really think that that's a decision that can be made by the people in the White House. Let me give you one example, and I'm not being critical, but when I was president, I was running about 7 miles a day, 40 miles a week. I was an avid runner. I never had the press follow me on a run. That was one of our best-kept secrets, when and where I was going to run. Quite often out by the C&O Canal, and sometimes over around Haynes Point, different places, but always without any knowledge by the press. The first time I met with President Clinton, after he moved into the White House, he was complaining to me that the Secret Service and he were followed by the press when he ran. And I said, well, they won't follow you unless you don't let them know ahead of time. But he said, well, I'll think about that. But he still prefers for the press to follow him while he's running. And another thing was, I'm an avid fly fisherman. One of the best-kept secrets of my presidency was that I would slip off to Camp David. The White House press would leave me. I'd get back on the helicopter about an hour later and fly up to a secret place in Pennsylvania and fish for a couple of days and come back to the Camp David, meet the press, and go back to the White House. They never knew it. I couldn't keep secrets about, Russian things and weapons and so forth, but I kept secrets about where I was going to run. So the point I'm making is that I think that each president, each family can decide whether or not they want to be exposed to the press. Another thing is, we had 2 sons living in Washington. One was Chip, who thoroughly enjoyed every aspect of being one of the first sons. I mean, he relished in it. We had another son, a little younger, named Jeff, who did not want any publicity. Chip got maximum publicity. Jeff got 0. So there again, you know, there's a choice to be made by a public figure, how much you want your private life to be exposed.
Amy, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. I sort of agree with that. Although I think at times that perhaps it's unavoidable that things are going to be written about you, or that the press is going to relate things that you would prefer not to be public knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But since there's nothing that you can really do about it, I really believe that the thing to do is just to develop within yourself some kind of view of that happening that allows you to ignore it.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
It has.
Jimmy and Amy Carter collaborated on the new children's book, The Little Baby Snoogleflieger. This is Fresh Air. The new novel, The Truest Pleasure, is about a family divided by religion, a division between the Baptist Church and revival meetings, between a somber service and a service in which the people are so overcome by the Spirit they speak in tongues. The novel is set at the turn of the century in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, where the author Robert Morgan grew up. Robert Morgan now lives in upstate New York, where he's a professor at Cornell University. The Truest Pleasure is about the marriage between Ginny, who expresses herself most deeply at revival meetings, and Tom, who finds revival meetings embarrassing, a place where people make fools of themselves. Ginny has stayed away from the revival since she married Tom, but in this excerpt, read by Robert Morgan, she's convinced her husband to come with her to a revival, and when the preacher speaks, she feels he is speaking directly to her.
The Lord says somebody here tonight has stayed away from the Spirit too long and has been lukewarm, and she must rededicate her life or find the Spirit has turned away. Preacher Jarvis looked straight at me, and I knowed it was me that was meant. I felt like I was naked and my bones was bleaching in his glare. My dirty, sinful heart was visible to all. A pain went through me, and it was like my heart was tearing my chest. I had to move to get rid of the burden. I couldn't stand my blackness any longer. I saw that I had been away from communion with the Spirit. I'd tried to trade marriage and human things and reading and even hard work for the business of praise. I'd ignored what was best about myself, most satisfying. I'd lost something, and I had to get it back. I had to let go of myself to save myself. Still holding little Jewel to my chest, I begun to shout, and I moved among the crowd, saying, "Jesus, I give you my life. Take it. It's yours." I guess I did a kind of dance, swaying among the people. I didn't notice I had moved across the sawdust to the front, still holding the baby. Jewel had woke up and screamed, but I hardly noticed. Milk come out of my breast and soaked down the front of my dress, but I didn't pay it any attention. It was only when I got to the front of the tent and turned that I saw how Tom looked at me. I was feeling the sweet inner burning of the Spirit. I felt I was floating up above my life. But Tom looked shocked and scared. He come forward and took Jewel and jerked me by the wrist out of the tent into the dark.
Robert Morgan, thank you for reading that excerpt of your new novel, The Truest Pleasure. The rift in this marriage between, the wife who wants to seek redemption in Pentecostal meetings by giving herself over, and the husband who is very distrustful of this, that split parallels a division in your family, in your grandparents' family, over different forms of baptism.
Right. It's actually a split in the whole community I grew up in. I grew up in Green River in western North Carolina, and there was a split in the church and in the community going back into the 19th century, mostly having to do with just that, the conservative hard-shell Baptist who wanted traditional services and the Pentecostal holiness people who wanted more emotional services with shouting and speaking in tongues and that sort of thing. And it came right down into my time in the 1940s and 50s.
What, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the differences between the two. Were they both Baptist churches?
Well, the Pentecostal Holiness Church got started around the turn of the century, but it was based on holiness kind of religion that had been around a long time. In fact, I think in my community it went all the way back to Wales, to what was called the chapel ecstasy in the Welsh religion. But there are theological differences between the Pentecostal Holiness and the Southern Baptist. An example of the kind of theological arguments I heard as a child between my grandfather, who was a Baptist, and my father, who leaned toward the Pentecostal Holiness, had to do with falling from grace. The Baptist believed that once you were baptized and joined the church, you were saved forever, in effect. And the Pentecostal Holiness believed you could backslide and not get into heaven unless you had had the baptism of fire. And that's a very important point of difference. And this comes up in the story that Jenny has the baptism of fire.
What is the baptism of fire?
Well, it's some special sanctification that people can get through the experience of a service. It's revealed through things like speaking in tongues and shouting. It shows that you have some special blessing. And this was the point of argument that came up most in discussions when I was growing up.
Did your father go through a baptism of fire?
He did, and he often spoke in tongues and shouted at meetings, and of course the Baptists disapproved of that. They thought that was shameful behavior.
Did you attend both churches, the Southern Baptist and the Pentecostal Holiness?
I did. I attended the Baptist church regularly, Green River Baptist Church, and also camp meetings and revival meetings where these other things took place.
What was it like the first time you saw your father speaking in tongues?
Oh, it was terrifying. I was not able to write about that sort of experience really until I was almost 40, when I wrote a poem about seeing my father speak in tongues for the first time. I went off to college, of course, and took psychology and discovered there was something called glossolalia, and there were psychological explanations for the phenomenon of speaking in tongues, but it still scared me, I think, to talk about it. And finally, about 1984, I wrote a poem called The Gift of Tongues, and it was after I wrote that poem I realized one reason why it might have been so scary to me to see this kind of thing and hear it. I was sensitive to language even then, and it was language out of control. It was a purely spontaneous language. And writers want spontaneity and inspiration, but they also want control over language. They have to have that at the same time.
It's also language without narrative meaning.
Well, sometimes it's supposed to be interpreted by somebody else at the service. That's one of the ideas, that there is a particular receiver there in the service who can get up and translate for everybody else what this message is.
So would you be willing to describe what you experienced watching your father speak in tongues?
Well, it was electrifying. I can remember just feeling frozen almost. I'd never heard anything like that, and I felt as though I was in touch with something very different from any other experience of language I'd ever had.
Did you feel like suddenly he was not somebody you knew, that he was possessed by another force that made him different?
Exactly. It was a voice I had never heard before from him, but at the same time, I felt as though I recognized that something way deep in memory was connecting with that. That this was a new level of experience.
Now, did you want to be carried away by the Spirit like that, too?
I think I was both attracted and repelled. In fact, the poem I wrote about this experience ends with me going up on the mountain and clenching my teeth and enjoying the gift of silence, I called it, to show control that I could resist it. And I think I made up my mind even then that I somehow wanted to stay away from that sort of experience, and I wanted to find a freedom out of that sort of intense religious experience. I can remember, even as a child, how good I felt going out of the church and listening to the wind and the pines outside and seeing the stars overhead, how peaceful nature seemed in contrast to the theology, the threats of damnation and hellfire and that sort of thing in the church.
I want to get back to your novel, The Truest Pleasure. The novel set at the turn of the century in the Blue Ridge Mountains where you grew up. Did you learn a lot about yourself and about your family by writing this novel?
It enabled me to go back and to remember things I hadn't for a long time. I was lucky to grow up in a family of storytellers, people who were interested in history and in the history of the community and the family. And as I began to write fiction, I realized I had all these stories that I could develop, go into, and yes, the act of writing is an act of discovery, often of things you didn't know you knew, things you had forgotten. And this particular story, The Truest Pleasure, let me go back and recover a lot of things I had forgotten about revival meetings, even about farming. There's a lot of details about farming, about the social life of the family and the community.
One of the things I found interesting in the novel, the woman in the novel, when she's in her late 30s, is thinking about what a pleasure lovemaking is and what a truly transcendent experience that is. And she thinks to herself, who would have dreamed that a middle-aged woman could feel this way? And I think being in her 30s was much older then than it would be now.
I believe that's right. A woman in 1910 who was 39 was thought of as a pretty old person. And she's remembering how she felt when she was a kid. She would never have dreamed that a woman that old would enjoy lovemaking so much. But her marriage is very intense in that way. They're very very much attracted to each other, she and Tom. And except for this difference over religion, they're very close. One of the pleasures of writing this book was to try to get into the mind of a woman in that period, to get the voice right, and to try to imagine how she would see things and how she would talk about it.
What did you do to imagine how she would see her own sexuality?
Well, I think that writing across gender that way puts a writer, a male writer, on his honor, to do a little bit better job, to become a little bit better writer than you would be otherwise. This is the third story I've told from the point of view of a woman, and I discovered that once you get the voice talking, it's almost as though it writes the story for you, and you do write down things you didn't know that you knew. So the key to it is getting the voice. Once you hear that, you can go ahead with it. And let the character tell the story and come up with the insights that you simply didn't know about, you didn't know you had.
It seems to me the main character in your novel is has been brought up in a fairly sexually repressed way. She doesn't think that a woman should really express herself freely in that matter. And yet her spiritual expression is so free. So it's a period where it's an interesting mix of repression and abandon.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the religious experience may have been a way of breaking through that repression for her. That's the way I see her. She had experienced this ecstasy in the brush arbors, in the meetings, and that perhaps enables her to be so intense in her sexual life also.
I imagine growing up in your family, especially with your father, going to revival meetings and, you know, being overcome by the Spirit and speaking in tongues, that you grew up with this idea that there's a way of getting close to God, that there's a way of being kind of overcome by this spiritual presence. Now, you are no longer a church-going person. Do you get that sense of transcendence from something else?
Oh, I think so. I think that one of the things I learned as a child was that the spiritual is very important and is always there. And whether you're in church or out of it, or in a denomination or out of it, it doesn't matter. Many of the most spiritual people I know have nothing to do with organized religion. But I don't think I've ever lost the sense of the importance of the spiritual and how much it defines people. People really wouldn't be themselves without it.
What does the spiritual mean to you without the framework of an organized religion?
Well, it means many things. It is awakened by the experience of nature or other people or language, reading, by music. It is the experience that reminds us we're more than just material, that there's a way in which, as the word means, transcendental, that we're not just chemistry and physics and biology, but something else.
When you were writing The Truest Pleasure, you had to imagine what it must feel like to be possessed by the Holy Spirit, to give yourself over to that completely. Can you imagine what it's like, and is it something that you wish that you had experienced at least once in your life, just to feel it, to know it?
Oh, yeah, I think I'm hungry for all experience. That doesn't mean I will try anything, but no, I want very much to know how people feel and how they see things, and to know extreme experience as well as the more ordinary ones. I believe there's a story that somebody once saw Henry James at a murder trial in rural England, and they said, what in the world are you doing here? And he said something like, well, wherever there's passion, there I'm going to be. I feel the same way. I want to know how other people feel and experience things. One of the pleasures of writing fiction really is to escape yourself and try to get into somebody else's head and to see how they see the world. It's not unlike acting, I believe, that it's not just to express yourself, but to try to imagine how other people would express themselves.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Robert Morgan's new novel is called The Truest Pleasure. He's a professor of English at Cornell University. Coming up, some holiday gift suggestions from linguist Jeff Nunberg. This is Fresh Air. We've asked some of our contributors for holiday gift suggestions. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, has some books to recommend.
Just about any bookstore I go to, they've got the language section wedged in at the back of the store with the other books that inhabit the literary territory that the Times Book Review describes as advice, how-to, and miscellaneous. I always have the sense they put the language books there just to keep the word geeks from disturbing the other customers. Most of the books don't deserve a better fate than that. But every year, there are a couple of them that you want to pull out and stick on the racks at the front of the store. The hands-down winner for the coffee table language book of the year is the Cambridge Encyclopedia of the English Language, a big, colorful book by the English linguist and polymath David Crystal. It's not designed for easy reference, but if you leave it in a convenient place and leaf through it from time to time, you'll find the damnedest things here. The origins of the comma, pictures of the six known signatures of Shakespeare, a method for estimating the size of your vocabulary, or the 9 different intonations you can use in saying yes. And there are lists of just about anything that could be listed: the differences between British and American English, 40 synonyms for thingamabob, the 106 two-letter words recognized for use in Scrabble. It's all a bit chaotic, but then so is the subject matter. If you're looking for a book you could actually sit down and read through, you could do a lot worse than Steven Pinker's The Language Instinct, which has just come out in paper after spending a couple of months last year on the bestseller list. Pinker's the closest thing that linguistics has to a Stephen Jay Gould or a Stephen Hawking, a noted scholar with a gift for lively prose. What he gives us here is a version of the controversial thesis originally developed by Noam Chomsky, that there's a universal genetic program that shapes not just human language, but also a lot of the features of human culture. But Pinker covers a lot of fascinating territory along the way, from the linguistic significance of tongue twisters to the place of Homo sapiens in the biological order. If you have a serious interest in understanding language, The Language Instinct is one-stop shopping. Of course, most people who say they're interested in language are really interested just in words, particularly when they come with curious stories attached to them. And every year, the publishers oblige them with 10 or 20 new books that bill themselves as treasure troves of word lore, or rambling excursions down the highways and byways of our speech. Most of these are pretty slight affairs, but this year there's an exception in Bill Bryson's book, Made in America. Made in America is something much more ambitious than the average word book. It's a social history of the nation from the point of view of the language, which takes us from pilgrim to PC in both senses of the term. There's a chapter on words for food, for example, that's a miniature history of eating in America. Bryson's discussion of the history of the word chocolate takes us from its first borrowing from the Nahuatl language of the Aztecs to a biographical digression on candy magnate Milton Hershey. Made in America is a word book for people who really don't like word books, precisely because Bryson keeps reminding you that the history of words is always part of a larger story. You wish more language writers could learn that lesson, then maybe their books would be allowed out of that purgatory at the back of the store.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of A Christmas Memory by Truman Capote, and the modern library edition of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.